is the Development Policy Centre podcast. I'm Ashley Betteridge. On September 25, the Development Policy Centre and ANU Gender Institute co-hosted the Australian launch of a major new World Bank report titled Voice and Agency, Empowering Women and Girls for Shared Prosperity. Jenny Klugman, Senior Advisor at the World Bank, presented the report's main findings. It was then discussed by an all-star panel, including Sex Discrimination Commissioner Elizabeth Broderick, Dame Carol Kidu, a former Papua New Guinea Member of Parliament and advocate for women's rights, and Ewan McDonald, Deputy Secretary at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade.
So welcome to the ANU and welcome to this event, which is being co-hosted by the ANU Gender Institute and the Development Policy Centre. My name is Matthew Dornan. I'm based at the Development Policy Centre and I'm really standing in for Stephen Howes, our director, who unfortunately cannot be here today. Stephen is currently travelling to a conference overseas. So I'd like to begin with by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we now meet, the Ngunnawal people, and by paying our respects to their elders, past and present. Shortly, I'll be handing over to today's chair, Fiona Jenkins, who is convener of the ANU Gender Institute. Before I do, I would like to very briefly highlight how excited we are to be co-hosting this important event, and of course to have such a distinguished panel of speakers to discuss the new World Bank report being presented by Jenny Klugman. This is a topic that the Development Policy Centre has a strong interest in. We're currently, with funding from Australian Aid, supporting Family PNG, a local NGO which runs a case management centre in Leh it assists survivors of family and sexual violence, predominantly women and children, to access the services that they need. And you can find out more on that project in flyers that we're distributing outside at the door. I might just stop there. As I said, a very brief introduction. I'm sure that this is going to be a really interesting seminar and that we'll have a great discussion afterwards. So please join me in welcoming the chair for today's event, Fiona Jenkins from the ANU Gender Institute.
Thank you, Matthew. And I too would just like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people on whose traditional lands we meet and pay our respects to their elders past and present. This has been a hugely exciting week of events for the Gender Institute, and I just, before I introduce our speakers, I just want to mention a couple of them to give you a kind of flavour of some of the work that we're doing, and which really I think relates very closely to the discussion tonight. So on Tuesday, we co-hosted the second annual Dialogue on Women, Peace and Security, which gives civil society a chance to engage in discussion with the departments responsible for implementing Australia's National Action Plan on Women, Peace and Security. And at that discussion, we heard very strong statements of support and commitment on that agenda from the Chief of Defence, the Australian Federal Police, and DFAT spokesman, Dr. Ewan McDonald, Mr. Ewan McDonald, who is speaking again this evening. So it's a pleasure to have you here again. On Wednesday, we were again co-hosts to a day-long discussion linked to Australia's role as present host of the G20, which was thinking about how global leaders might best advance women's economic empowerment. And that was a day of discussions that was put together by Gender Institute member Sue Harris-Rimmer, in conjunction with the UK's Chatham House. And I just want to quote something that Sue noted in her brief for that event, because I think it really speaks to this evening's discussion. She said, the agenda of women's economic empowerment needs its pivotal moment, as the Security Council had in 2000 with the emergence of the Women, Peace and Security agenda and the passing of Resolution 1325. And I think that's really something to think about. As she put it, there's a nascent discussion on inclusive growth and investing in gender equality measures for employment, and this needs to accelerate. Leaders need to demonstrate awareness of and accountability for the gendered consequences of their decisions. And we need to expand the policy focus in thinking about economies, noting women's disproportionate burden of unpaid work. And I think that's very, very sort of nice way of setting some of the agenda around this this question of women's economic empowerment. Now, a leading voice in that room yesterday was that of Dr. Jenny Klugman, and this evening we welcome her to describe the incredibly comprehensive work she's done with colleagues at the World Bank to explore the implications of women's status globally in this report, Voice and Agency, Empowering Women and Girls for Shared Prosperity. And there are copies of that report outside, so do please help yourself to a copy as you go out of the room. Jenny Klugman is a senior advisor at the World Bank and a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Women and Public Policy Program. Her previous roles include Director of Gender and Development at the World Bank Group, where she served as the lead spokesperson on gender equality issues, and she was responsible for developing strategic directions to promote the institution's gender agenda. We also welcome her here tonight as an impressive alumna of ANU. She holds a PhD in economics from here, as well as postgraduate degrees in both law and development economics from Oxford University, where she was a Rhodes Scholar. Now, after Jenny has spoken, we'll hear from some from the rest of our panel, and I'll introduce them now. Elizabeth Broderick is Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner at the Australian Human Rights Commission. And amongst very many achievements in this role, she is internationally renowned for her development of the Male Champions of Change strategy. And every meeting I go to, this is cited as something really innovative, important, and in need of progressing in every area. In April 2011, the government appointed her to lead the Commission's review into the treatment of women in the Australian Defence Force. And she continues to work hard with the ADF on embedding cultural change. Again, incredibly important work. Elizabeth's also a global co-chair of the Women's Empowerment Principles Leadership Group, a joint initiative of the UN Global Compact and UN Women, and she's a member of the World Bank's Advisory Council on Gender and Development. Dame Carol Kidu is a former Papua New Guinea Member of Parliament and Minister for Community Development. She was first elected to Parliament in PNG in 1997 and retired in the 2012 election. Between 2002 and 2012, she was the only woman in the 109-member Papua New Guinea Parliament, and she ended her political career as the leader of the opposition. She's been described as a visionary reformer because of her commitment to transform legislative and policy frameworks for social development in PNG, in communities as they interface with Western society. And amongst many other honours, Dame Kidu has been awarded 3 honorary doctorates, and she has very extensive international experience on a wide range of high-level advisory boards. Our final panellist tonight, Mr. Ewan MacDonald, is Deputy Secretary at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. He joined DFAT as Deputy Secretary in November 2013, following the integration of the department and AusAid, where he was the Deputy Director General. Previously, he was a Deputy Secretary in the former Department of Education, Employment and Workplace Relations. So a wonderfully qualified, wide-ranging panel. And we'll hear from all the speakers, and then there'll be a chance for discussion. So please join me in welcoming all of them. And I'll invite Jenny to come forward.
Thanks very much, Fiona, and thanks to the Gender Institute and for the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University for hosting us here this afternoon, to our esteemed panel, and to all of you for joining us here today. Expanding the voice and agency of women and girls is integral to the global development agenda. When women and girls are able to speak up and be heard and to make decisions that matter to them, to their families, their communities and their nations, everyone benefits. That's the main headline coming out of Voice and Agency. Today I'll just focus on 3 messages: why it matters, what is the scale of the challenge, and what we can do. But I do want to start briefly by clarifying what we're talking about. What is Voice and Agency? Voice is about people being able to speak up and be heard, and to shape and share in decisions, discussions and discourse. Agency is about people being able to make decisions that matter to them, about their lives, their families, their communities and their countries. Today we're focusing on girls and women, many of whom have no say over whether, when, and how many children to have, who are unable to buy or inherit land, who have no say over major decisions at home and in their community, and who, in their hundreds of millions, are battered by their husbands. These are deprivations of agency that violate basic human rights and which hold back development. In a very basic sense, none of this is new. Indeed, 188 states have ratified the 1979 convention that outlaws discrimination against women. And 75 countries have constitutions that outlaw discrimination by gender. This is the context within which we undertook this major program of research to address these challenges, building on the 2012 World Development Report on gender. We had an extensive process of consultations, research, analysis, and engaged with a wide range of world experts in this field, including people in this room today. The slide here presents the book's table of contents. We begin with key cross-cutting issues and then proceed to address a series of specific challenges, beginning with violence. In most of the world, no place is less safe for a woman than her own home. The map here shows regional rates of violence inflicted by intimate partners, which reach as high as 43% in South Asia. More than one in three women globally have been subject to physical and or sexual violence. And in the vast majority of cases, this is in the hands of their husbands and or boyfriends. The total numbers, some 820 million, are startling. Close to the total population of sub-Saharan Africa and almost triple the population of the United States, for example. This region, as many of you would know, suffers from among the highest rates in the world, ranging as high as 60 and 70% in countries of the Pacific. These statistics reflect enormous personal tragedy and suffering. While human dignity is arguably priceless, intimate partner violence also has a high cost. We undertook estimates to quantify these costs, and across a whole range of countries discovered that these range between about 1.5 to 2 or 3 percentage points of GDP, which comes close to or exceeds what most countries spend on primary education, for example. In Peru, as we see here, the cost of intimate partner violence is some 3 times what the government is spending on primary schooling. So then the question is, in the light of such enormous economic costs, why do these widespread breaches of human rights persist? Our major finding and a recurring theme throughout the report is that bad outcomes are being driven by regressive social norms and bad laws. We looked at patterns in over 50 developing countries to see how regressive norms play out at the household level. We used the demographic and health surveys to investigate norms like accepting violence, thinking it's okay to be beaten by your husband, having no say in major household spending decisions, and being married before your 18th birthday. The Venn diagram here highlights the headline global results across the 54 countries, that almost 4 in 5 women suffer at least one of these deprivations, and this is across all income groups, urban, rural, across a whole range of countries, and that more than 1 in 8 women suffer all 3 deprivations at the same time. And behind this global picture are countries where the situation is even worse. Here's the case of Timor-Leste, for example, a country close to us here. We can see that virtually all women, some 93%, experience at least one of these deprivations. Many are subject to all 3, some 1 in 5, and some 90% think it's okay to be beaten by your husband. And when looking at the profile of these deprivations, we try and find the common factors. And one element that emerges very clearly is little or no educational attainment. This slide here shows the differences in the rate of suffering these deprivations among women who have primary or less education versus those who have secondary or more education. It shows that women with primary or less education are significantly more likely to suffer at least one of these deprivations, some 90%, and also much more likely to suffer all three at the same time. We also find that lack of education is associated with lack of sexual autonomy. Among women who have graduated from university, they're much more likely to say that they're able to refuse sex or ask their husband or partner to use a condom, for example, whereas many women who have only completed primary education are unable to do so. There's more analysis in the book, so I won't go into those details here. And then finally and not least, education also reduces the incidence of early marriage. I mean, clearly these impacts are working in both directions, but we do know that girls who finish high school are up to 6 times less likely to marry early. Far too many girls around the world are also wives and mothers. Globally, 1 in 3 girls are married before their 18th birthday, and 1 in 9 before they turn 15. On present trends, more than 142 million girls will be married before their 18th birthday. On a daily basis, that's some 39,000 girls. Among the factors that can make a positive difference, we find that land and housing is important. Alongside education, alongside economic opportunities, our control over land and housing is associated with greater self-esteem and respect from other family members in the community and with larger economic opportunities and mobility outside of the home. There are also a range of studies which show how it affects girls' survival rates, their nutritional status, as well as their progress through school, which all suggest quite far-reaching benefits. But around the world, we see that women are substantially less likely to own land. What the graphs in this slide show are differential rates across a whole range of countries, again, drawing from the demographic and health surveys, although interestingly, a narrowing in the gap in a number of African countries, like Rwanda and elsewhere. In all this, voice matters. Women's voices and girls' voices can be transformative. Indeed, our review shows the grassroots women's movements have played a critical role in influencing change, including legislative change. Women's groups have also worked effectively in enabling economic opportunities. Having more women in decision-making positions, including in parliaments and in cabinets, is critical. Having more women in office is important in itself and can have positive implications for reform. An increase in the number of female lawmakers in Rwanda, for example, led to progressive legislation on inheritance and reproductive rights. And around the world, a higher presence of women in parliaments is correlated with better perceptions about government legitimacy. But here, again, despite some encouraging gains, women remain politically represented around the world. My understanding, and I think we have an expert here from the Pacific, is that the share of women in Parliament has never exceeded 10% and indeed is much lower in many countries. And looking this afternoon at the Interparliamentary Union figures for Australia, I see that Australia has now dropped to some 50th rank in terms of the share in women in Parliament. It's below Afghanistan and Ethiopia, among others. So why is this? In large part, it does seem that it has something to do, again, with adverse norms and attitudes. What this graph does here is show a strong correlation between attitudes about women in leadership and their representation in Parliament. But I did want to draw your attention to a couple of outliers, Rwanda and South Africa. And in both cases, the introduction of quotas in Parliament seem to have driven change. Before the African National Congress established a 30% quota in 1994, South Africa ranked 141st in the world in the share of women in Parliament. Now it's something like 8th or 9th in the world. And I think many of you would know that Rwanda occupies first place again with quotas in place. So change is possible. It's a daunting agenda that's long-term in nature, but where there are major opportunities for progress. And one obvious candidate that we explore in some depth in the report and where we have seen some progress is legal reform. This graph here shows trends in legal reform over the last 50 years. And we can then it shows the number of discriminatory laws that were on the books in 1960 and then in 2010. It shows that in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, the number of discriminatory laws on the books on average fell by half. By way of contrast, we look at Middle East and North Africa and South Asia. There's been alarmingly little advance. And despite this progress overall, legal discrimination remains pervasive. In just last year, some 128 countries had at least one legal difference between women and men. These are legal differences which range from obtaining an ID card, restrictions on owning or using property, obtaining credit, and even getting a job. In 28 countries, mainly in Middle East, North Africa, and in South Asia, there are at least 10 such differences on the books. Still, here again, there are signs of some positive momentum. Some of you may be aware of the prominence of addressing gender-based violence in the dialogue around the post-2015 development agenda. And the momentum around legally sanctioning domestic violence is indeed encouraging. 3/4 of the 100 countries recently studied by Women, Business and the Law criminalise domestic violence. This is remarkable given that only 3 decades ago, only one country outlawed domestic violence at home. However, a minority of these countries, only 38, have introduced tailor-made laws to address and explicitly criminalise marital rape or sexual assault within marriage. Of course, laws alone are not enough, but they are an important start and make a difference. The analysis that we did found that women who live in countries that do have this domestic violence legislation on the books are significantly less likely to face violence and experience violence. Furthermore, and possibly not surprisingly, the longer the legislation is in place, the lower the tolerance for violence in terms of these norms about the acceptability of violence. Having strong legislative responses is critical, and progressive laws and their enforcement are important in creating change. But they're only part of the story. Education is critical, although in our study it seems that secondary education and above is really the most important. Economic opportunities can be pivotal, and social protection programs can play important roles as well. Underlying all of this is the importance of changing norms. This requires broad-based participation in the change process, engaging men, boys, community elders, and community leaders are all potentially important allies. Indeed, programs that only target women are likely to bring only partial results. And we shall investigate a range of programs which engage boys early and bring success from around the world, from Brazil to Burundi and Malawi. We focus in particular on gender-based violence and what works. Together with colleagues at the George Washington University, we recently completed the first global systematic review of the evidence about what works to prevent violence. This included some 180 impact evaluations, albeit largely from developed nations like the US. One important kind of point that I want to raise here is that whilst the evidence from rich countries like the US and Australia is important, we do need to be investing more in the knowledge base in poor countries to understand what works. And there is work underway now to both innovate and document what works and building the evidence base in developing countries. So what do we know? We know that programs need to target both men and women. We also find that the most promising interventions have multiple components. They deliberately address norms, they involve the wider community, and they span longer periods of time, at least 6 months. What about specific examples? Here I'll highlight less than a handful among the growing number of promising approaches from around the world. These are programs which have been tried and rigorously tested in the field. Tostan in West Africa is a community empowerment program that uses social networks to spread awareness about human rights and how to build healthy communities. It's best known for its success in combating female genital mutilation, and it's now operating in some 450 communities in Africa. Program P is part of the Men Engage campaign. It promotes men's practices as equitable caregivers and changing norms facing boys, particularly boys in vulnerable communities, and combating, again, violence against women and children. And finally, and more recently, evidence from Uganda and the SASA program. And those of you who are interested in this topic, I would encourage you to look at these very encouraging results, again from a longer-term program, very much community-based, but achieving very impressive rates of reduction in violence, some halving of rates of violence, not only changing attitudes, but changing actual behaviours as well. So there are important implications for the World Bank and other development partners for our work on education, our work on social protection, as well as our work on economic opportunities and jobs. Indeed, expanding women's economic opportunities can be one of the game-changing events that can make a difference in affecting norms and expanding agency. I saw this recently in Rwanda in the context of our adolescent girls program, talking to girls who'd gone through a vocational training program that was combined with deliberate efforts to increase their confidence and aspirations, as well as life skills and knowledge about reproductive and sexual rights. And it was increasing, indeed, their confidence and aspirations. This is a major policy challenge, and I think bringing in some of the work which is needed in changing norms into some of the conventional programs around economic opportunities is a major entry point in the period ahead. Change requires more and better data and new measures to track progress, so we can all learn whether we're making a difference and we can also be held to account. The final chapter in the report is on data gaps and addressing those gaps in data and evidence. There's an eloquent quote here from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton: data not only measures progress, it inspires it. We look at the various areas where gaps exist, including with respect to data on aspirations, on confidence, measures of participation in politics at the local level. These gaps are being increasingly well recognised, and there are a number of efforts underway to address these in practice with good innovative work in the field, and I've mentioned some of those here. Finally, before closing, I thought I'd just share with you some of the reception to the report. The global launch took place in May in Washington, D.C. The fact that we had Hillary Clinton could have brought possibly some increased attention to what we think is an important report. But the reception on social media was indeed encouraging. We made a major splash, actually trending on Twitter nationwide in the US. In DC, there were queues out the bank and around the block to come and listen about the report. The reception in the media more broadly has also been positive, from conventional news outlets, television, radio, as well as in print. Our team has been able to document some 400 stories, news stories, which have covered the report. Next month, the report itself will be formally published as a book. It's pretty much the same as the version you're taking away today, so you don't need to reread the book version. But we're hoping that way as well it will have a longer shelf life, and indeed will enable kind of researchers and activists in the future to continue to build on the results. Voice matters. Agency matters. When women and girls can make meaningful choices, where they can make their voices heard, everyone gains. Ensuring that they're able to do so is simply the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. And we don't have Hillary Clinton, but we do have the completely fabulous Liz Broderick. So come on up.
It's sorry not to be Hillary Clinton, but anyway, you've got me. But have you got the little presser?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Jen, there it is.
I'll need that.
Thanks. But thank you so much, Fiona, and I just want to recognise the great work that the Gender Institute is doing. I mean, Fiona talked about the week that the Gender Institute has had, and I just think all the different initiatives that you're involved in, I mean, it's fantastic, because just even 2 years ago before you were set up, we wouldn't have seen that level of momentum. So congratulations, Fiona, on leading that. I also want to thank the Crawford School for hosting the Australian launch of the World Bank's report in Voice Agency, Empowering Women and Girls for Shared Prosperity. And I start by acknowledging also that we're meeting here on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal people, and to pay my respects to elders past and present. But as I have the privilege of sitting on the World Bank's Advisory Council on Gender and Development and seeing the great work that Jen does every day, and I remember when we started first discussing the possibility of a report on voice and agency, I mean, it was clear to everyone on the council that without a strong evidence base to support change in this area, we just wouldn't make progress. And it comes off the back of a 2012 World Bank's Development Report, which was really the first really significant report that the World Bank did, focusing solely on gender equality. So it's such a great delight to see the report finally come to fruition, to see that Hillary Clinton, you know, really an iconic world leader, launched the report, and just to see the momentum that the report has actually created. And I want to particularly pay tribute to Jen, because Jenny Klugman has led the efforts at the World Bank for several years now. She's spearheaded this research. Without Jenny, we wouldn't have either the World Bank's Development Report on Gender or this report, which are just such important contributions to the global picture. So go, Jenny, I say. And I think one of the most important things Jenny's been able to do is help those economists at the World Bank see that gender equality lies at the heart of global economic prosperity. So, Jen, you've done a great job in that, because that's not that easy. Changing the military's hard, changing the World Bank, that's really hard. So I've been fortunate, as many of you know, to be Australia's Sex Discrimination Commissioner now for about 7 years. And I have to say, it's such a privilege. It's a job that takes me under the ocean in submarines to the United Nations here. That's with Catherine Smith. You may remember, a survivor of domestic violence, and her daughter who addressed the United Nations, to the Beyond the Forward operating bases out in Afghanistan and Oregon province, to working with survivors of acid attack in Bangladesh, to camping out with Aboriginal women, to the male champions, and everywhere in between. And through my work, I've really been concerned by the lack of women's economic empowerment that remains not just across the world, but that actually remains here in Australia. Because there's no question that it doesn't matter where you look, every country in the world, women get paid less. They do the lion's share of unpaid caring work. They're overrepresented in part-time and insecure work. They're discriminated against in the household, in markets, in workplaces and institutions. And just to bring that back to Australia, women on average earn 18.2% less than men, and you'll be aware that it's the pay gap is now the largest that it's ever been since we started measuring the pay gap here in Australia. That 43% of employed females aged 20 to 74 years work part-time, compared to 14% of employed males, and that women represent 55% of casual or workers in precarious employment. And indeed, the National Review into Pregnancy and Return to Work Discrimination, that you may be aware, we just released the results of the National Review just about a month ago, it found that one in two women here in Australia reported experiencing discrimination in the workplace at some time, either when they announce they're pregnant to their manager, when they go on parental leave, or when they return to work. One in two in 2014 in Australia. And sadly, sexual harassment in the workplace is also a very common reality. We know that just over one in five people aged 15 years and older has experienced sexual harassment in the workplace in the last 5 years. If I look at women, that's one in four. And just to put it into context, that's the equivalent, almost equivalent to the combined populations of South Australia, Western Australia and Tasmania. And I do want to recognise Sally Moyle's fabulous work on sexual harassment. Sal did the first ever sexual harassment prevalence study back in 2003. We now have two further iterations, which shows us that sexual harassment is not getting better in Australia, that we still have a long way to go to change this picture. So this discrimination, sexual harassment, the gender pay gap, the unpaid care work, they're all significant contributors to the lower workforce participation of women. And if I look at women's workforce participation rates, it's 58.9%, which is 12 percentage points lower than men's workforce participation rates. And the net result of all this, you don't have to be Einstein to work this one out, is that women are far less likely to have economic security. Over a quarter of female employees do not have access to paid leave entitlements. And when I look at the superannuation payouts, men versus women, the fact is women have just over half the superannuation payouts of men, so sitting at 57%. And we've started reframing this issue to ask the question, is poverty to be the reward for a lifetime spent caring? Because that's where many women are at in this country. But the statistics can't tell us everything, and one of the tremendous privileges of this role is that I get to meet with women and men all across this country. Whether I'm working with refugee women, Defence Force personnel, women with disability, women in low-paid work, Aboriginal women, every day I meet inspiring individuals, individuals who are committed to creating a more equal world, and particularly in their own sphere of influence. And that was never more evident to me than going on the National Inquiry. I went to every state and territory around Australia. I spoke to hundreds of women and men for this inquiry, and I heard the stories of thousands of others. And I heard from talented people who had missed out on promotions and job opportunities because of pregnancy, because of wanting a flexible work arrangement. I heard from mothers and fathers who were pressured to accept a reduction in salary or not to look for career progression because they worked in flexible work. In the words of one woman, she said, "Look, while I was on maternity leave, my boss told me there'd been a business decision that I was no longer suitable for the role I was in previously. They'd offered it to my full-time to my maternity leave replacement." I have to say that was a constant theme coming through. But my boss said, "Don't worry, I've managed to secure your position in another department, but it's a $20,000 pay differential." And I have to say, in a sense, I went into this inquiry thinking with a little box which kind of was labelled men's discriminatory views. I'll just pop them all in there. But no, actually some of the most discriminatory views were held by other women, women with children. And so when you work out what that's about, I'd be really grateful if you let me know, because I have to say it was very, very depressing to understand that. As this woman said, she said, "I described my experiences during pregnancy whilst on parental leave on returning to work as harrowing, disappointing and probably the worst experience of my life. I spent much of my pregnancy feeling anxious and sometimes in tears despite being thrilled about the pregnancy and being physically well. I felt powerless, vulnerable, and fearful about my job security." We just heard that so much as we travelled around Australia. "And I couldn't understand why I was being treated so badly, especially given my unquestioned commitment to the organisation over the previous 7 years." So I think what these voices, and they are the voices of women and men affected by discrimination, what they teach us, is that discrimination at this point is a real and pervasive issue. It crosses all rungs of the labour market in Australia, and there is no sector that is immune. But not only that, it's a major barrier to the full and equal participation of parents, and in particular, mothers in Australia's workforce. Which takes me to the report which we're launching here, or Jenny's launching here in Australia today. This report plays an important role in really laying bare the issues of gender inequality, discrimination, lack of voice and agency across the world. And I think for me, it's fundamental that the report recognises that at the core of disadvantage and poverty amongst women is an environment that constrains their voice, constrains their agency, their capacity, and not only that, it violates human rights. Importantly, in developing the report, as we've heard through Jenny's presentation, surveys were undertaken, there was a lot of hard data generated, and for me, one of the most shocking statistics is that today, in 2014, because that was from the Business and Law 2014 report, there are still 128 countries that treat men and women differently. And as Dr. Kim said in the foreword to this, the Voice and Agency report, he said, these constraints are fundamentally unjust and economically unwise. And I couldn't agree more. The report highlights the entrenched social norms that disadvantage women, that constrain their agency, whether that be in relation to accessing land, education, capital, employment or training, or in relation to decisions about marriage, women's sexual and reproductive health, or in relation to the violence so many women face in their daily lives. And I remember when we were at the World Bank's Gender Advisory Panel recently, we heard that the number of women living in an intimate relationship characterised by violence today is outstripping the number of malnourished people in the world, I think is what you said, Jen. So, you know, this is at epidemic proportions. No doubt the overarching conclusion of this report is that enabling women to make decisions and to have their say is absolutely critical, not just to changing the picture for women, but to changing the picture for their families, communities and societies generally. And the fact is we have to start by reforming discriminatory laws. We have to follow through with concerted policies and public actions, including multi-sectoral approaches that engage with men and boys to challenge adverse social norms. And I think that comes through really strongly in the report. And I thought I'd just close now by just telling you a bit about one of the strategies that Australia's using to engage with men. And Fiona referred to it in her introduction, and that is the Male Champions of Change strategy. Because it's a strategy that focuses on working with those in the seats of power. It's actually a strategy around power. It recognises that men invented the system, men largely run the system, we need men to change the system. And we need men also taking the message of gender equality to other men. That's what's going to start to shift some of these pictures. So about 3.5 years ago now, kind of enlightened by this new insight. I mean, I'm a bit of a slow learner. It took me a few years to get to this point. But I established the Male Champions of Change group, which is now a group of 24 of Australia's most powerful and influential men. So they're the CEOs of companies like Telstra, like Qantas, like the Commonwealth Bank, like ANZ, like Woolworths. They're men who lead global organisations like Citibank and Deloitte and IBM. Men who hold senior roles in government, like Martin Parkinson, the head of the Treasury, Ian Watt, the head of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and David Morrison, the Chief of Army. And I made a personal plea to these men. I said, will you use your power and influence, your collective voice and wisdom, to create change for women in this country? So it's not about speaking for women. It's not about saving women. It's about stepping up beside women and taking accountability for the progress of gender equality in our nation. And I remember the first conversation I had, I rang the guy who was the head of IBM at the time, Glenn Borum, a terrific CEO, and I knew he had twins, a twin boy and a girl. And I explained to him that today in Australia, women only hold 3% of CEO positions, 18% of board positions, blah, blah, blah. The basic rule is the higher up you go, the less women you'll see. That's as true as tax and gravity, I have to say. And I also talked to him about the fact that while women are excluded from power, whether that be economic, social or political power, they will be marginalised all across Australia. And I think whilst we've been talking about the numbers for decades, what shifted for this CEO was an understanding that without intervention by decent, powerful men like him, that this story would become his daughter's story, that his daughter would never have the same opportunities as her twin brother. So not only did he start to understand the case for change with his heart, he started to understand it with his heart. And I think that's the shift about making the case for change personal. But what have our champions have done? Well, they've written to every business leader in this country making the case for change. They've developed their own leadership model, which looks at four aspects. I'll just show you that some of them up there. So they look at what I say, how I act, what I prioritise and what I measure, because they understood that they weren't living up to their own aspirations. They said they cared about gender equality, but when they got around their organisations, they were only talking about revenue and costs. They weren't talking about gender equality. So that's really what's shifted. They are now always asking the question, 50-50, if not, why not? The idea being, if women make up over 50% of this population, why am I not seeing 50% of them here in the graduate intake, you know, coming onto the global development program? Those types of questions. They're looking down their supply chain and signalling to their suppliers, and they have budget or collectively of almost $100 billion to spend on products and services annually. Once you start looking down your supply chain with over 100,000 suppliers and saying, you know what, we want to do business with people who care about gender equality just like we do, that starts to have ramifications. So they're starting to do that work, and they're doing a number of things, one of which is taking the panel pledge, which is that they want to speak on panels which have some level of gender balance. And there's a bit of a backstory to that, but we can talk about that later. In fact, Martin Parkinson, I think, spoke at the Institute not so long ago, and it wasn't a terribly gender-balanced panel. And he was able to start off his speech by saying, well, you know, as a male champion of change, I actually really care about gender balance. And if we are to accelerate progress for women, they need visibility. And in the future, I'll always be speaking on gender balance panels. So it had impact, his opening to the conference. But I think my main point today is that the achievement of gender equality can't sit on the shoulders of women alone. And when we take shared ownership, and as Jen said, and she had on one of her slides, it's about women and men, that's very important. That's when we're going to stride forward together. And I think the other point to make is, and it comes through in the Voice and Agency report, is, look, we can change corporate Australia. We can work with governments to reform legislative and policy environments. We can work with the military to change culture. But if we don't change the informal social structures that sit around us and exist in our families, we are not going to make the progress that we need to make. So this report speaks to the importance of ensuring women and gender equality sit at the heart of our discussions on our economic future. With the G20 forum being held in Australia this year, there have been a series of related forums, and one of which the Gender Institute has run. But what is stark, and what this report points to, is just how critical women's empowerment and participation is to economic prosperity and growth. And I think we need to ask ourselves a question, as policymakers particularly, are we prepared to put to one side the talent, the creativity and skills of half the world's population purely on the basis of gender? Because actually that's what's at stake when we talk about these issues. This issue needs to be a priority issue, It's not a women's issue. This is a systemic issue that determines the well-being of all of us. And my final point is that if we don't actively and intentionally include women and girls, then we will unintentionally exclude them. And that will be to the detriment of all our economies and nations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Liz, for that. And I'm not going to use my Hillary Clinton line again, but we do have one of the world's great women leaders here with us, Dame Carol Kidu. Please come forward.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. And I must say, having to follow Jenny and Elizabeth, I feel quite daunted. And to be very honest, I thought I was coming to talk for about 5 minutes, just commenting. So I'm even feeling even more daunted after seeing those tremendous presentations. Please, I hope you haven't got a tremendous presentation. Yeah. I'd also acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, and I would like to acknowledge the people of Pari Village, the people of Moresby South, who gave me the great privilege of being a Member of Parliament in Papua New Guinea for 15 years. And if it weren't for them and those people, I would not be standing here, and I would not be on any international board, whatever I'm on. And so I acknowledge the people of my husband's village and the people of Moresby South. I thank also the Crawford School of Public Policy, the Development Policy Centre and ANU Gender Institute for making it possible for me to be here. And I'm very grateful for that. And I had a wonderful morning session today with a group of postgrad students, some of whom are sitting here now, and it was very illuminating. At the time when I was asked to speak at this, I thought, oh, gee, I've chosen the wrong person. Because, you know, being a former politician and being like I am a rather cynical person, I'm always kind of thinking, oh, God, not another report. A report that will sit on a desk and gather dust. That's the kind of type of person I am about reports. And I actually did not get this hard copy till last night, and I've been racing in all directions, and I didn't get read the full electronic one, so I'm making lots of confessions. But I will say that I'm glad I'm here to comment on this report, because for me, it gets so many tick, ticks, ticks, so it's brilliant, Jenny. It really has got to the crux of so many issues, and so I'm very glad to just make a few comments, in part from PNG perspective, but just in other ways. I have already started dog tagging, and I think people now who've collected these will go home, and they'll become very tatty in a very quick time, and I hope they will be seen not in the just in the realms of academia and research areas. It's very important that such reports leave academia and research and go into the hands of politicians, bureaucrats, and all development workers, because there is so much wisdom in the report. It will define, according here, the World Bank president said, a bold new path towards equality, grounded in fundamental human rights and backed by evidence and data. And there couldn't be a better statement than that. Voice and agency. Empowering women and girls for shared prosperity. I have to be honest again. I've always felt very uncomfortable with this buzzword, and it's not a new buzzword now, but it's relatively new, agency. I've always felt kind of uncomfortable about it. But this report has really helped me to come to grips with that word a little bit more. As I stand in front of you today, you would be thinking, oh, she's a woman who's got agency. True? But if you saw me sitting in the Vahoy household in Pari Village, it's a different matter. And this is something that I feel we've got to actually delve into more. How much can an individual have agency in a communal society? It's very, very a difficult two-sided coin that we have to explore even more. But this report has gone towards that a little bit, and it states here, it talks about agency as the ability to make decisions about one's own life and act on them. I must admit, I can't often do that at home sometimes. And to achieve a desired outcome free of violence, retribution, or fear. And the ability to make those choices is often called empowerment. But it also brings this other issue that I keep worrying about with this word, Agency is also about group and collective action, as we and it gets examined in here. And I think that is an extremely important thing to keep unpacking. How can an individual have an agency within a communal society that dictates how that individual should behave? And so while we empower women and girls and develop their agency and the agency of all people, we must make sure that the communities that they are going back to are also very much sensitized, or it can develop a dangerous situation for those empowered individuals if they go back into communities that have not gone through the same sensitization. And so I think it's an area that there's lots more research to be done. It's a very interesting area. To what degree can one feel this agency in a communal society? If we look at Papua New Guinean agency, agency is very clearly stated, really implicitly, in the constitution of Papua New Guinea, agency for women and girls. It's there in our constitution. It's a document that gives me goose pimples, and I always used to think that in Parliament, we shouldn't have just said a prayer at the beginning of sessions. We should have read sections of our preamble of our constitution and keep reminding ourselves about the beauty of that document. Because our constitution is very clear about women, girls, inequality in goal number 2, equality and participation, and in the directive principles that come with the goals, like the directive principle about equality, marriage shall be based on equality and equal responsibility of both parents for the upbringing of children. It's stated there very clearly in our constitution. And I think we should be quoting constantly from that mama law of the country. Section 55B recognises a reality, though. It does recognise that there will be many constraints for agency for women and girls in Papua New Guinea. And Section 55B is a section on the possible need for affirmative action in the legislative development of Papua New Guinea. And I drew on that section very regularly, trying to convince my male colleagues that what I was trying to do in reserve seats was endorsed in our constitution by Section 55B. Section 50 of our constitution states that the necessity for equal opportunity for all citizens, regardless of blah, 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 including sex, you know, equal opportunity. And my colleagues used to valiantly tell me, they have equal opportunity, Carol. They have equal opportunity to stand for elections. But that's not the point. I used to say, yes, but do they have equal opportunity to win? And we all know the answer to that. When I was 0.9% of the population, but the actually persistent lobby towards reserve seats had a wonderful result that we now have 3 women in Parliament, 2.8% of the Parliament is now female, and Fiji has just got 8 women into Parliament. Woo-hoo. And so there is progress being made in the Pacific, but I referred today in our talk, little dialoguing today, that in the French territories where they use the parity laws, it hasn't made the countries fall apart, and maybe we should be pushing for parity laws in the Melanesian countries as well as some of the French territories where they get aimed for 50-50. So our constitution is very clear on this whole thing about women and their rights, and that really comes down to agency. Our problem is the enabling legislations and the other laws. But there has been a lot of progress made. The major reform that I did in 2002 to the criminal laws on sexual violence, rape, etc., which removed the removing the marital defence of rape, to the dismay of many of my colleagues, I tricked them, as I said later, but you have to learn to be tricky in Parliament. I tried to do it in November 2001 as a standalone to remove the marital defence of rape. And I was going brilliantly, I thought, you know, pretty naive, private member, backbencher type thing. And we were working on that. Then in came a couple of males, and they really went off about me interfering with their bedrooms. Went down dead as can be. So when we did the total package of reform, slipped it in, nobody read it all, it went through. Talked about all the other things, about the protection of our children, etc., etc. But, you, I mean, it's not my fault. Okay, we've now got the Family Protection Bill, We've got a lot of work being done in reform. We have a lot of work, and a lot of it thanks to our development partners also helping in this. There is a lot of things about the rhetoric of legal reform and policy and the reality on the ground. There's a big gap still, and so we need to work still on that. But that is an ongoing long story in any nation. I've just heard these incredible figures still for Australia, you know. So why do people talk about Papua New Guinea so much? Yeah, I mean, quite phenomenal. So there has been a lot of reform going on, and it's ongoing. But the actual, for example, removing the marital defence on rape was 10 years ago now. No more than that, 12 years ago. It's only now starting to get traction and getting some, you know, cases going through in court because the police and people didn't want to touch it. So it takes time. Okay. I think also this report, it gets very thoroughly into the life free from violence. There's only one area I feel is a little bit missing, and interesting that, Elizabeth, you made a side reference to this area, I think. And it was interesting, one of the young postgrad students that today, I don't know if she's here, one of the ones today made reference to this issue, of the issue of lateral violence amongst women and within communities, and how do we address lateral violence, because I strongly believe that it is a deterrent for development. So it's an area we need to look at, the lateral violence, as well as the gender-based violence, the family and sexual violence. But let's unpick it a bit more, this area of lateral violence and how it holds people back, and tall poppy syndrome type stuff, but a bit more intense. I want to go on to one other thing and then I'll stop. I think, too, for us in Papua New Guinea, there's a great need to expose the myths that have developed in recent years that have been to the benefit of males. There are huge myths about culture and tradition and women traditionally, and about things like bride price. Unfortunately, with the linguistic imperialism, when that custom of Dava in my husband's society and different names in other societies was looked at from a Western eye, through a Western cultural lens, it was seen as buying a woman. When I was first in Pari village in the 1960s, that was not the essence of Dava. In fact, Dava protected women and gave her certain rights. But now, definitely, it has come to the detriment of women. It's become that women have become commodified. So it's important we dispel these myths and say, that's custom, it's our custom. Hey, let's get back to really how that custom worked and the various protective behaviours that were implicit in the marriage exchange wealth between families. It won't go back to that, actually, but how can we manage the way these things are evolving that is often to the detriment of women? Some of our PNG academics have actually analysed it, and they would argue, and I tend to agree with them, that in many ways women were better off and had more protections traditionally than now. But if you think of that situation, what came into Papua New Guinea was an extremely patriarchal system. In the era of missionisation and colonisation, our Western society was extremely patriarchal. And that put a blanket over a whole lot of things, and it intensified many things. So these things, for us, looking at all these areas of agency, let's get back and expose the myths and say, well, how do we move forward? We can't go back, so how do we move forward and accept things as they were? I want us to talk a little bit about this area of the economic opportunities and the importance. It's very interesting, the Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development, Tracy's here somewhere, this huge Australian DFAD program for the Pacific area. It has identified three critical areas for working with women in the Pacific region. The women in leadership, they all come up in this document as well. The women in leadership area and the voice for women are on the decision-making tables at all levels, not just national. We must look at all levels, as has been brought out before. The issue of violence and its impact on women in the region and globally, and the issue of need for economic empowerment. Now, doing consultations very recently in the Highlands, I kind of introduced the idea of economic empowerment plus, because we have to be very careful we don't drive a model that is purely, let's get cash in their hands. I want women to be focal and central in what I call a dual economy, but maybe it's wrong. Give the potential for them to earn cash, they need it. But also, the total family unit should maintain the traditional economy as well, if they are in that environment. Because it's too often you see things where there's economic development, like a road built, people stop their gardens, they get cash in hand, suddenly it's finished, and they've got to start redeveloping that. Why can't we drive the two together? The two together. And so I think it's really important in our design work to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, if that's what we say. The access to land, absolutely critical, it comes up in here, the access to land and resources. And here we have to look at the interesting new emerging vulnerabilities that need to come into any studies. Widows had protective customs traditionally on how they had access to land. Nowadays, I've seen so many widows marginalised from their land, their house, all sorts of things, sometimes in greed. So the multiple deprivations, as being called, and the new vulnerabilities, deserted women in polygamous marriages, which are not polygamous. They're actually serial promiscuity. They're not polygamous. So all of these things we have to look at, because all of these things are killing women's and girls' agencies. And the last thing I want to say is I'm really pleased that this is such a progressive report. Thank you, Jen. We are not talking just about maternal mortality. We are talking about sexual and reproductive health and rights. Woo! Woo! Go and tell the Russian delegation at the global consultations. Woo! Tell the Iranians. I mean, I've been told very clearly at some of the consultations with the high-level task force, I just got back on Monday for the latest meeting we had, we were told very clearly, there are only human rights. There are no such things as women's rights or sexual rights or sexuality rights. I don't quite understand it. So thank you, Jen, for a very progressive document that gets beyond just women being mothers, but gets on to their sexual and reproductive health and rights as women. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dame Carol. And I should advise you that Liz Broderick does have to leave to get back to Sydney, so we'll farewell, Liz. And our next speaker, I'm very glad in the context of all this discussion of male leaders of this agenda as well, that we now invite Mr. Ewan McDonald to come forward.
Okay, good evening, everyone. And I think Dame Carol said that she was in awe of people before her. I'm in awe of all three. I feel quite inadequate up here after hearing all three of them. But I did want to like others. It's, I don't know if that's my phone, but anyway, it's sort of ring. No, because it's likely to be the minister's office or something, so it's fine. So, look, I firstly wanted to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're meeting on today, the Ngunnawal people, and pass on my respects to their elders, both past and present. And I'd also very much like to also pass on my thanks to the host tonight, the Gender Institute, the Development Policy Centre, ANU, and the Crawford School. And I think it's a fantastic event that you've put on. It's a fantastic week you've put on, and Fiona and Stephen and the team should be congratulated. I also should say, Matthew, that I actually went and saw the Case Management Centre on its very first day in Leigh, and I was incredibly impressed by the 9 people working there, the case managers and the assistant case managers, and also the leadership of Daisy, who was running that centre, which was an incredibly important centre in terms of providing support to women who've been affected by domestic violence in PNG. But I suppose what I really wanted to do is commence by congratulating Jenny, like everyone else, and the World Bank on an outstanding report. I must say, from my point of view, in going through that report and looking at the evidence base under it, it's really compelling in terms of the action that needs to be taken, and I sort of lined it up against the new development policy that the government put out in the middle of this year and our priorities and how they line up. And I also found it quite confronting, to be honest, to see some of the statistics that were still emanating through that report and some of the challenges we've all got as leaders to address those sort of issues. So I really did want to congratulate you on a fantastic effort. I also wanted to point out that we also have a number of champions within the Australian system and certainly in my day-to-day work, and we've seen people present here and throughout the week who are very committed to gender equality and women empowerment. And I wanted to sort of talk a little bit, just for a few minutes, about the new aid policy. And as you probably know, it was launched by Julie Bishop in June of this year at the Press Club. And she did that at the Press Club because she wanted to go out and actively promote it. And as part of that, gender equality and women empowerment was one of the six planks. And it was very important that it had its own sort of focus. It's important that it's integrated across the program, but it was important it was sitting there as a key sort of focus for us in the aid program. But in the speech, and those of you who may have heard her, she said perhaps our most important priority, and one that is a personal passion when referring to the gender equality and women empowerment pillar. And she went on to say, when women are able to actively participate in the economy and in community decision making, everybody benefits. And across each sector and priority area of Australia's aid program, we're increasing the focus on gender equality and women empowerment. And Liz referred to Sally, our gender specialist, sitting here in the front, and the tremendous work she's done. And also Kathy, who's one of our division heads in Foreign Affairs and Trade, who's driving through the new agenda as part of the work that we're doing on setting up a new aid policy in each of the countries that we work in. So I wanted to also acknowledge the work that both of those, and if anyone else is here from the department, I'm also acknowledging you as well. But I wanted to say in relation to that we know that the evidence provided in the report is something that we want to use to be able to argue our case. And Dame Carroll talked about, you know, in some of those forums we get into and the differences of view, I think the evidence base is incredibly important in being able to argue our way forward. The other thing I wanted to mention in our policy is we've done something different, and was talked earlier today about data and the importance of measurement, and there are 10 sort of high-level performance targets in the new aid policy, and one of those goes to affect 80% of our investments will effectively address gender issues in their implementation. And I've been asked many times, well, why 80%, why not 100%? Well, at the moment there's about 74% of our investments have gender built into that investment. But what's not measured is whether it's effective or not. So under the new measure, and I see this measure progressively going up, you've actually got a hurdle for people to jump in terms of the number of investments they integrate gender specifically into, but also a measurement of the effectiveness of that, which is really what we want. We don't just want words, we want to actually have an effective program that makes a difference on the ground. So that's the other point that's important. In terms of the Asia Pacific region, I thought you might be interested to know that we lose about $47 billion annually because of women's limited access to employment. And we lose $30 billion annually due to gender gaps in education. So you can see that some of those areas that Jenny talked about earlier around the importance of education and what that means in terms of particularly secondary education or vocational education, because often what we focused on in development or aid is access or getting people into school. What is also incredibly important is the quality of that education and what knowledge people get as they come out of the system at the other end. So that's another focus on our program that's totally consistent with what's being done here. I had a lot more things to talk about, but I won't, because I really want to open it up for questions. So if you want to know what we're doing in relation to the program, I'm happy to lead you through the website and identify all those great programs. But there is one thing I did want to mention. Last Friday in the United Nations Security Council, there was a discussion on Iraq. And during that discussion, Julie Bishop, who was representing us, had to intervene on Iraq. If you go and have a look at the interventions last Friday, you'll see that she was one of the few that went and specifically addressed the impact on women and girls of the conflict, both in terms of domestic violence, if you like, sexual violence as part of that, in terms of their opportunities and support, particularly if you think about all the pregnant women and the like that are needing support, and provided funding to the United Nations, the UNFP, to take action in relation to that. So while everyone else was very focused on the conflict, she was also focused very much on the impact on women and girls. And I think this is really important in forums, that we get the opportunity to actually lead. So this leadership aspect of our program and the leadership we have both from Julie Bishop and Natasha Stott-Despoyer are incredibly important. And in finishing, I just want to say to Jenny that the report is vital in progressing our work for women and girls across the globe. Reports of this nature are essential to governments. They're also essential to civil society and the private sector in providing evidence to formulate policy and programs that will address gender equality and women empowerment. And through our aid program and diplomatic efforts, I want to see the Australian government working to respond to the issues you've identified in the report to ensure that we're providing whatever support we can to make a difference to women across the globe. So thank you.
So thank you. Those were just very interesting comments on a very, very, very important report. We are open to the floor for question and comment. So if you'd like to say very briefly who you are and where you're from as you ask your question, that would be terrific.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a fascinating presentation, actually. I enjoyed the whole talk. I'm Vinod. I'm a PhD student at the School of Archaeology and Anthropology, and doing development studies actually there. And I'm conducting research on, basically, I'm from Nepal, conducting research on gender issues in Nepal. And I don't have a specific question, but you know, like I have some observations and some comments from based on my research. One, like about the property rights, land rights, you know, like in Nepal, I'm taking some cases from there. Government of Nepal decided to, you know, like give kind of tax, they, you know, like when you register land, they decided to decrease the registration fee for women. And men, although they have got all decision-making powers, they make the ultimate decisions, started registering the land as the women's property, which is not true. You know, like that doesn't reflect the true picture. Actually, men make all decisions. One. Second, when I was conducting my research, I encountered a very interesting picture over there. Like, relationship between husband and wives are considered as a kind of, there are a lot of acceptance. Somehow, you know, like many women, I had some problem being a man, you know, male researcher conducting research with women. But you know, like women share some of their stories, and they say like slapping or scolding, they are not gender based violence, but then because that happens in hand. That means we don't get the true picture, even if like in gender based violence in that context. I'm coming back to here at ANU, being a student, and you know, like many of us getting funding from different sources for our study. And I got a very interesting picture in one of the fundings here at ANU, like, particularly for women. Like, they have a special condition. I'm not comparing men and women. Women have got special conditions. They can be pregnant during this study period. And one of these scholarships, you know, one of the funding sources, somehow, it's not discouraged, and it may be wrong to use the discourage, but they ask students to take kind of leave, but they will not get any payment for that period. You know, like somehow, in a sense, they are discouraging women to be pregnant, or you know, like to take their rights in another sense. Mm. And within Australia, within this context, and that was kind of surprising to me. Mm-hmm. These are some comments. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
No, thanks very much. I think that the points that you make around kind of reported ownership on land is important, and it is complex, and even when it's ostensibly joint, it may not really be joint. Mm. And there is some good work on this from a range of countries, you know, more detailed kind of qualitative work and understanding what's going on. At the same time, what we do know is what I mentioned in the presentation is that higher levels of reported ownership are associated with greater self-esteem, larger economic opportunities, and some of these other outcomes that we care about. So there is something going on, but it is true that we need much more, I think, care in terms of measurement there. I think that your points as well around the acceptability of violence are very important, which get back again to norms, and so that's why we focused on those questions which are available in the demographic and health surveys around the acceptability of violence. Because if you look at any of the figures around actual reported rates of violence, and we have a section on that in Chapter 3, it's abysmally low. You know, it's in single figures in virtually all countries, so very, very few women are actually reporting violence, partly because they think it won't make any difference, partly because of fear, but also partly because of norms as well. Mm.
We have a question for you. Hi, my name's Ellie Hillis, and I'm currently consulting for the World Bank. One of the questions that I have wondered about for a long time, that I haven't ever taken the time to know whether there's been any work done on this, is to do with women's agency, and it's to do with women's voting patterns. And I have wondered whether anybody has done, I'm sure they must have, done any work on whether women vote differently to men, and in those societies where women's votes are not private but are in fact influenced by the presence of their husbands or other members of male members of their family, whether the outcome of votes might actually be different if women were voting somewhere else and their vote was truly private. And what would happen in a society where gender-based violence is very high, would those women, if their votes became known, would they be subject to recriminations?
We'll take that question and...
Yeah. Someone in the audience might be able to answer the question. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Margaret Tolley from ANU. Thank you. I mean, this was a wonderful panel, and I was especially pleased to hear from Liz Broderick, I mean, partly about some of the shocking statistics and very discouraging, regressions that are happening in the Australian context. So I've worked my way through about half of the report. I think it's a really excellent report. Mm-hmm. Just to carry on some of the questions, I mean, of course, when we're looking at economic empowerment, in the Australian context, we are looking at a situation where we're dealing with a commodities economy for the most part. And just to follow on some of Dame Carroll's really important points, I think, about the PNG context, is it's very, you know, I mean, we often use words like dual economy or formal, informal, and so forth, but often from the perspective of the women who are actually doing all of this work. I mean, this is just like one world, in fact, that you're sort of having to juggle between. I really like the recent metaphor of Cathy Gibson and her colleagues about the floating coconut, that the kind of commodity economy is what we see on the surface, and what is hidden underneath and often invisible to foreign observers is what's at the bottom of the coconut. And so I think it's really important, I mean, certainly from some recent research a number of us have done, to look at the way in which, you know, market economies can empower women in certain contexts, but alas, there are also market economic processes, and particularly I think around land, in with the impact of extractive industries, here I'm thinking PNG, Vanuatu, in another kind of context, where in fact women's kind of control over land and housing is actually getting worse rather than better. So thank you, and I think having the Australian experience right alongside the global experience was really incredibly compelling. Thank you very much.
Can I invite each of you to respond to those set of comments? So, Jane, would you like to go first?
Sure. I mean, I'm not familiar with evidence on the voting pattern side, although there is evidence about a kind of greater representation of women and kind of progressive reform on a whole range of issues, particularly social policy, but also around kind of reproductive health and services and so on. But I just wanted to pick up in response to this important point, something which Dame Carroll also mentioned around what she referred to as economic empowerment plus. Because I think thinking about kind of broader notions of kind of what access to economic opportunities can do, and on the one hand, actually, in many cases, increasing the burden, and Liz spoke to that as well, but also thinking about programs which have kind of overall empowering influences, and kind of narrowly focusing on just capital or just vocational skills may not be enough, you know, without thinking about the networks and the changes in attitudes and norms. And actually, some of the evidence that we review in the report shows that in a number of countries, it's been shown, or in some contexts, among particularly lower educated women, that access to cash income can actually increase their exposure to violence, you know, and increase tension in the household and so on. So I think it's important not to be seeing economic opportunities per se as being a solution, but having kind of more nuanced understanding of kind of the potential contributions and what's needed in order for it to be kind of truly empowering.
I think, with the one with the voting patterns, I think probably it's true of many societies that probably voting patterns tend to be family-based rather than women or male-based. But in PNG, there has been a move by the Electoral Commission to have separate polling boxes, stations for women, although they really were in very close proximity, but the women used one and the men used another. I don't know that it made any difference because it's still very much a family influenced pattern. Sometimes the women will vote as differently, but often it's just a family thing. Yeah. I certainly didn't ever rely on a woman's vote. Yeah. I focused on families. Yeah. And the other one, well, I just mentioned a few things. I think we've got to really, look at how we do our economic empowerment programs. And there's been some interesting work happening in Papua New Guinea with using the coffee industry and economic empowerment and focusing on women in the coffee industry, things like that, and at the same time encouraging other self-sustaining things for families, like doing fish farming, teaching new things that start off, actually they started off as a subsistence type protein provision type thing, but they themselves became economic. But you've got to not just focus on the cash.
I just think the question on the voting, Ali, was very interesting. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it that much in terms of that and whether there'd been any research done. And it's interesting. I was thinking, what happens in Australia? What actually happens in my family? Yeah, because, it's interesting to think, what impact that would actually make. Yeah, it's very interesting. In terms of the economic opportunities, I agree entirely. Your example, one of the things we don't often think through in entirety the impact on what we think is going to be a good idea, and actually the impact on other things that are incredibly important within the community, or because we actually go with a value set or an idea that sort of works for us, if you know what I mean. So that's why this sort of community ownership and sort of input into any of the sort of decisions we make, I think, are incredibly important, because you can have unintended consequences that really impact on the social sort of fabric of the community. And it's tough, you know, it's difficult issues to work through, but I think, you know, you've seen many times where people have come with what they think is the right thing for a particular country or area, and you've seen it in Australia. You see it in Australia. So I think it's a really important point you've made.
Hi, I'm Christine Robertson. Hi, my name's Ruth Jackson. I'm working on a project that's funded by AusAid, DFAT, trying to increase the last round of the efforts. Increase skilled work attendance in Ethiopia, and I'm quoting Jenny's report, closing the deadly gap between and I know you've got health extension workers in Ethiopia in that project, and health extension workers are the largest group of health workers in Ethiopia, almost 50% of the workforce. Generally, they're all women, and the women I've been working with, the health extension workers, have virtually no opportunities for promotion, for training, and they cannot move as other government workers can, and they can't put items on the agenda for the village committee meetings that they must attend. So I'm just wondering, Jenny, maybe you could make a comment about how they develop their agency. In the workplace, because I've been working with them over the last year and a half, and they are the most incredible women. They're just amazing.
I mean, I used to work in Ethiopia, but I'm not very familiar with this particular program, but it seems to me that there need to be changes in the institutions and the rules, and then, you know, probably some concerted efforts in order to change the norms around that. Ethiopia is one of the countries where, you know, there are very high rates of violence and child marriage, you know, a lot of the adverse norms that we see. And I think that whilst the community health program has done a fabulous job in terms of extension, you know, reaching, you know, large numbers of women, I think helping to enable access to kind of contraception and control of kind of fertility decisions, you know, it's also kind of, as you've pointed out, created kind of a disadvantaged kind of class of women as well. So I think maybe, you know, there could be some dialogue around the need for kind of institutional reform.
I'm aware that we're running over time, so we're just going to take one last question. Oh, we've got one there. We've got two last questions, though, because I've already said yes.
I'm not going to use the microphone because I forget, so if everyone can hear. I'm Alison Bartley. I'm a development practitioner with ThinkOutLoud Consulting. It's fantastic. Thank you for the resource. One thing I just wanted to get to your view on, and I think it's a really great panel to answer this actually, is that I think the advantages of taking an economic approach to empowerment are really clear, but it's always concerning to me that that's going to devalue women's empowerment as a human right. Gender equality is a human right for women as an end of, you know, of itself. So I've recently returned from Palestine, where I was working on a project that was achieving huge social change in very patriarchal communities by working with women simply by providing them a safe space to build their confidence, their knowledge about their rights, and solidarity so they can support each other. I'm concerned that as we progress to focusing on economic prosperity is an outcome that will stop prioritising these, what are considered these softer approaches to women's empowerment. And I guess I'm particularly interested in your approach in terms of being a donor. Where does that sit as a priority when we've got this very economic approach to aid?
Let me take the other final question and then we'll get responses from the panel.
Hello, my name is Amparo. I'm from Honduras. I'm a master's student here at Profit Environment Management. I'm a lawyer. And back home, I used to work in big legalizing land rights over public forests. I was glad at first to see that almost 40 or 50% of our beneficiaries were women. But the underlying issue was that most of these women were headed households because their husbands and their sons had migrated to the cities or to the United States or elsewhere. So migration patterns were having a great impact on them, almost leaving them in more vulnerable conditions. So I was wondering if the World Bank, first, congratulations for this report, but in future reports, will you consider talking about how these migration phenomena are affecting women all around the world?
Okay, so I'll kick off the first question. It's a very good question. In terms of women empowerment and gender equality, they're just a right, as you said. They should be a right for everybody. The reason some of the statistical data is used for those that don't understand that is that even if you didn't support that because of your norms or your traditions or whatever the reason might be, there's actually an economic reason why you would do it as well. So, you know, and when that happens, you would hope people will see the benefit of that. And so it's used in a number of dimensions. So it's evidence-based. Well, if you're only concerned about the economy or your then here's an evidence-based to support. In terms of our program, those safe houses you've talked about, we use those, and I've been into Palestine, where you've talked about Gaza and the like, and the sort of shelters, etc., that are set up there, and also Afghanistan and places like that. They're incredibly important in terms, and that's why I've tried to say that there is not one solution to this. We need to look within context. We need to look at what's going to work. And although we might have a view that this is absolutely the right thing and it should happen automatically as a right, that is not the reality, as you well know, in some of the communities that we work in. So I think that's one of the reasons we use whatever statistical data we can to support this is the right thing to do. Yeah.
I don't think what I'm going to say is relevant. But we'll give it a go.
I probably wasn't either.
Yeah. I think it's really important that in any development worker, because I don't feel I've done very much at all, really, at the base level in development, to be quite frank. I think we've got to accept that the answer lies within, and we've got to assist people to facilitate the process so that they identify the problems, they ask the questions, they start identifying and move forward. It's slow, it's hard, and it doesn't fit into the time frames and ticking the boxes of a development project.
Yeah. This is what I'm concerned about.
Right, and that's the whole thing. It doesn't fit into that, and so it's about really nations taking ownership of some of these things, which maybe they're not putting as a higher priority as the development partners might be doing. It's very difficult because we know the pattern that quite often some of them excellent projects showing real promise, but they don't become sustainable because it hasn't had that longevity. That's why I like this present one with the Pacific Women one.
Yeah, the
there is some chance if we use it very sensibly, there's a chance that we can look at least a few areas, some longitudinal issues and sustainability coming in where you're trying to change the fundamentals of how people do things. And I think from outside we've got to understand that I've lived in a particular one tribal group in Papua New Guinea for 46 years. We've got a few other people here who've lived in another tribal group for many, many years. I don't pretend to understand it yet. You know, and we've got to accept this as development workers. And so that's why the answers do lie within. And sometimes my children will say to me, oh, for God's sake, Mum. You know, and I realise I thought about it from my Western brain, not from my Motu brain. And I just didn't anticipate the outcome. Yeah. So we've got to allow that space, the telenoa of finding that answer from within. Yeah. And it mightn't fit what we see as the answer.
I actually think that comment on longitudinal study is incredibly important. this 10-year program that Dame Carol talked about, and also
we can really use it too.
In education, we don't actually have any really longitudinal data, in my mind, that we should have now, and we need to get it because, you know, if you think about the Australian system of education, that's how we've worked out what we've done with a lot of our education system. We need that data, and we don't do it well.
We really need it in the end, yeah. The number of really well-qualified people I've found in villages in remote areas completely unused. Mm. Unused. They leave high positions and get forgotten. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not studying that.
Last word to Jenny.
Okay. Well, just on the mobility, I think it's a very important dimension, and migration. And it's actually covered to some extent in the World Development Report. We actually didn't have kind of the opportunity to give it the justice it deserves. There's another ongoing program of the bank called NOMAD, with a K, which you might want to track for further on that. And then finally, just on the kind of rights versus economics, I mean, it's possible to just focus on seed or focus on rights, but I think that in the end, like the champions of change, if you're talking to kind of ministries of finance and others who are making decisions, they're not necessarily kind of persuaded. So I think that's at the area of kind of political and policy decisions. And then I think at the micro level, one of the increasing realisations in terms of the bank's own work is that focusing narrowly on the economic side actually doesn't work. You do need to be thinking about the empowerment more broadly, about kind of girls being able to control their sexual and reproductive decisions, being able to have the confidence and aspirations, the exposure to role models and so on. So there's actually quite a lot of congruence. So I would kind of emphasise the areas where there are synergies rather than kind of set up false dichotomies.
Well, that's a wonderful note, I think, to end on. I just want to say a couple more words. I thought it was just lovely that we had that little voice of the toddler in the audience. And I think one of the things that we've got to recognise is that opening, you know, public spaces and opportunities to women is often going to mean involving children too. So I thought that was really
and the socialisation process.
Thanks to the Development Policy Centre, who've really done the hard in organising this, and especially to Makaroko, who has done great work bringing it all together. Yeah. Thanks to you all for coming. Thanks to our wonderful speakers. Great.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.